From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I saw airplane drop to the white thing. Then, same time, knock me down a strong wind. Then I don't know how long I was unconscious. But when I noticed, look around, I couldn't see anything. I couldn't hear anything. But just see red and black and gray, so dark. Then just like a dead country, a dead place.
58 years ago today, the United States dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Up to 200,000 people were killed. Today, we'll hear the story of a survivor and hear from a radio adaptation of John Hersey's book, Hiroshima. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Episcopal Church yesterday voted to confirm the first openly gay bishop in the church and the first worldwide in the Anglican Communion. The Los Angeles Times reports the Reverend Gene Robinson may be the first openly gay bishop of any major church ever. The vote was originally scheduled for Monday, but was put off after allegations of misconduct against Robinson emerged in the 11th hour, but the church's committee dismissed the allegations. Opponents of Robinson's confirmation have already announced they plan to appeal the vote on the international level. Conservative Episcopalians in the United States also called for a national meeting in October to possibly discuss splitting from the church to form a more orthodox wing of the Anglican Church in the United States. Robinson told reporters after the 62-43 vote, quote, "I am proud to be in a church which works to be a safe place for all of God's children." Pentagon officials have admitted they dropped firebombs on Baghdad during the recent invasion of Iraq. An unnamed Pentagon official told the San Diego Union-Tribune the firebombs were, quote, remarkably similar to napalm, the chemical that was used and condemned widely in Vietnam. An American who works with the Halliburton subsidiary of Kellogg Brown and Root has died in Iraq after a bomb exploded under his truck yesterday north of Tikrit. Arab League members voted yesterday not to recognize the U.S.-appointed governing council in Iraq. More information is emerging about what's in the 28-page gap of the Congressional 911 report. The New Republic quotes an unnamed official who read the full report. The source said it implicates, quote, the high levels of Saudi government. We're not talking about rogue elements, the source said. We're talking about a coordinated network that reaches right from the hijackers to multiple places in the Saudi government. A new study has revealed pregnant women who were near Ground Zero on September 11th were more than twice as likely to have underweight babies. The Center for Constitutional Rights yesterday filed a federal lawsuit against the Justice Department to overturn portions of the USA Patriot Act. It's the second lawsuit against the Patriot Act in 2 weeks. In the British village of Longworth, the former British weapons expert David Kelly will be buried today. Kelly died 3 weeks ago amidst a growing scandal in Britain when it was revealed that he may have been the high-level British official who told the BBC that the Blair administration had sexed up intelligence on Iraq. Officials say Kelly committed suicide on July 19th, days after coming under intense questions by members of Parliament. Kelly's comments to the BBC and his death have been front-page news in Britain for weeks. Some questions rose over his death last week when it emerged he was wearing 4 electrode pads at the time of his death. Health officials said he was undergoing tests on his heart. And the state of Texas is planning today to execute 40-year-old Jose Rivera. Rivera was convicted of committing murder and sexual assault in 1993. The state has rejected calls from Rivera's attorneys for DNA tests, even though the state's chief witness now claims Rivera is innocent. And you are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President George W. Bush is not the first president of the United States to lie to the public about weapons of mass destruction. On August 6, 1945, Harry S. Truman made an announcement to the American public. He said, quote, 16 hours ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima, an important Japanese army base. Well, the fact is, it was not an important Japanese army base. And in the ensuing years, 200,000 people died as a result of the bomb. 140,000 people died as a direct result of the bombing on that day. In his speech, Truman described the bomb as a revolutionary new force for destruction, harnessing the basic power of the universe. He warned if the Japanese did not surrender unconditionally, quote, they may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth. 3 days later, August 9, 1945, the U.S. dropped the second atomic bomb on Nagasaki. A total of 140,000 people died as a result of that bomb. Today on Democracy Now!, on this 58th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, we'll hear the words of survivors. We will turn to a radio adaptation from the Pacifica Radio Archives of John Hersey's famous book, Hiroshima. But first, we turn to Shigeko Sasamori. She's 71 years old. She lives in Marina del Rey, California. She was a teenager in 1945. When the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. Over the next few days, she suffered terribly, was finally found by her family, and years later was brought to the United States by the American journalist Norman Cousins with funding from the Saturday Review. He brought 24 young Japanese women to the United States for medical treatment. They came to be known as the Hiroshima Maidens. Shigeko Sasamori is in Hiroshima today dedicating a memorial to Norman Cousins. I visited her in Los Angeles several weeks ago. She told her story.
My name is Shigeko Sasamori. I am one of the survivors from atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. At the time, I was 13 years old, a junior high student. And that day, especially, first time young student have to go out to help the city. City people asked the school students to go to the mobilizing students to clean up the broken houses, because in Japan was a small narrow street, and in case a bomb dropped, people needed to escape away. So that morning, the first time I went to the place with my schoolmate, when I looked at the sky, it was a beautiful blue sky, and I saw the airplane. In those days, many times B-29, we call B-San, B-29 comes but never dropped the bomb. So sort of we was relaxed, and actually a blue sky and a white cloud with airplane, and so beautiful. So I said to my friend, look up the B-29s here on the sky. And I pointed my hand up the sky, and almost spontaneously, I felt the very, very strong light, more I can't explain how strong it is. Very bright light. But before the bright light, I saw airplane drop to the white thing. Then same time, knock me down a strong wind. Then I don't know how long I was unconscious. But when I noticed, look around, I couldn't see anything. I couldn't hear anything. But just see red and black and gray, so dark. And then just like a dead country or dead place. Then for a while, I was waiting. Just like a deep fog going away, fade away, the blackness, redness going away. And then I can see around the area. And at that time, I don't know how to describe, because I never been in hell, but when people say hell and heaven, that is a hell, horrible. And people wasn't people, just horrible, horror. But no one talk, no one say anything. My ear was didn't hear anything. It must be very strong shock. Then I just follow people at the nearby, they had a river. So I went to the river, and many people were already in, and some people are floating away in the water. And I, in my mind, bomb dropped. I thought the bomb dropped just my area. I didn't think the whole entire Hiroshima city. Then all of a sudden, my ear was open, the baby screaming. And then I looked down, so there was mother, the burn whole face and chest and the baby's burn. And mother tried to nurse baby, and baby just screaming. That scream, baby's scream sound opened my ear and conscious. Then I can see more clear and more, I can hear people talking, screaming, crying, all the noise. Then somebody said, better go other side of the river because maybe another bomb drops. Next to the river, we have a sort of a little hill. So everybody go to the hill called Hijiyama. So I followed them. That was early enough so I can able to cross the river. Then I worked with people to some schoolyard. After that, 4 nights, 5 days, I stayed at school. And only I can say is my name, Shigeko Sasamori, not Sasamori, Niimoto. That was my maiden name. Because I thought my parents worried me, and I wanted them to know. And also I said, please give me water. Then nobody paid attention. Of course, I couldn't open my eyes. 5 days, 4 nights, no food, no treatment. And I said, one more time, I said, somebody pay attention. One more time. Keeping myself saying that, then tells my name and the water. Meantime, my mother and father, of course, they was hurt very lightly, luckily. So my mother went every single day, look for me. And the fifth evening, somebody came to my house to told some young girl a certain place. So my father said, let's go get, because at that time my father was helping people gathering to give food and clothes that comes outside of the city. So those people bring in the city. So my father was helping every day the people needed. So he gathers men to bring wood, just a door, wood door. No car, nothing, just wood door. They carry wood door to come to the place, the men told. Then dark, and my mother said my name. Where is Shigeko? Where is the Shigeko? And I heard. And I said, here I am. But this is a miracle, I have to tell you. That at the time, I thought the first time I had a dream, because every day, no water, and nobody paid attention. So my conscious was out on. That night, I saw most beautiful, bright day, had a water well. Oh, that water, I'm going to drink that water. And my body is so heavy, but I tried to go get there. And near the well had a beautiful white pumpkin flowers, color, beautiful. So I said, water. Then a little bit closer, water well changed to the stream. And oh, the stream, I was so pushing myself, getting so hard. Then nearby water, then river, nearby river, pretty soon the like ocean, and ocean, oh, almost reaching. Then all of a sudden my body was hit like a rocket. Pew, to go up to the sky. And then all of a sudden my body don't feel heavy anymore. And inside was, if I explain what looked like is most the real gold. If you melt the gold, put into the gold, all surround the gold, just like that, shiny, beautiful. And same time, my body was so light, like a feather. And then my mouth, no more thirsty, no conscious of nothing, no family, nothing. Just happy, happy. And my ear is so beautiful, noise, not noise, music, more than music. I can't explain. Everything so wonderful and just feels so good and happy and floating all over. Then only I can see the gold, but I can feel sort of many people there, kind, but nobody there, but feels. Then same time I was enjoying, I heard Shigeko. Then I said, here I am. Dun. All disappeared, feeling everything. Then I saw a dark place and a little light, and people looking down and somebody white clothes, sort of spontaneously. When I conscious, I saw it, I felt the pain almost same time. And then I heard somebody saying, she has a very strong heart, that's why she can survive. I remember the words. Then, must be out of conscious. Then I can hear, oh, still burning over there. Oh, there, look over there, still burning. And the people talking, they carry me. I can feel. Then I out of the conscious again. Then near, must be got to the home. Neighbor says, oh, you find the Shigeko. Oh, how nice, how wonderful. You know, how she, people talking, I hear. Then I didn't remember. The next time I know, I was in the house and net around me, because the summertime and the many, many dead people and hot summer and not enough to burning quickly, so rotten body, so many black what's the name of it? I can do. No. Golly, fly. Fly all over. Flies all over. Because of the so many dead bodies. Then I was lying at my house, my mother take care of me. And later she told me when they find me, they couldn't recognize. Because my face was like a big ball, black ball. No eye, no eyebrow, nothing. My hair was kinking, burned. So first things my father did is cut my face skin and pour out. And underneath was cream puff. You know those, you eat cream puff and it's opening inside the cream, nice, thin, tasty things. My face like that. So my mother said, oh, have to open eye and open the mouth and I can eat and I can see. But no medicine, no doctor. So their house was just tinted, not real standard. And inside was everything thrown out. Then very, very lucky the house was survived. So my mother gets anything in the material, turn material, take off the puff infection. Then those infections go all over, next to my neck and all over. I burned 1/4 of body, front half, up, both hands, both arms, neck and chest and whole face. So while I'm lying down, people come to see me and talking to my mother. Is she still alive? Is she still okay? Everybody thought I'm going to die. And also people said, what a terrible outside. We cannot walk without moving a hand front of the face because flies. And everybody's walking street, their back is all black because flies stuck. That much, just horrible, horrible things.
And so then, after you began to heal, at the time, again, you were 13 years old. How did it end up that you came to the United States?
Yes. I was going to the church, Methodist Church, and Mr. Tanimoto, Reverend Kiyoshi Tanimoto. He and Mr. Norman Cousins had a project for moral adoption. And children lost the parents, so American people send money like moral parents. Those projects they are doing. And just one day, I walked into the church. I met Mr. Cousin and the Reverend Tanimoto talking in the church. Then Mr. Tanimoto introduced me to Mr. Cousin. And also he explained he had a group, a Bible group, for who are damaged, burned face, and young girls. So he was very interested, and he wanted to meet us. So that night, we had a meeting. Then he went back to America, and he asked American people to donate money to bring girls to the plastic surgery operation. So it took him to 1 or 2 years. Then 1955, 25 girls came over. This is really, really human love start from there. We are so lucky to come to this country. And many people ask me, why you go to America? America dropped a bomb. America is enemy and things like that. But I said, no, bomb dropped, yes, but that was a war. I hate war. But American people, they didn't do it. And especially some people don't know what happened to us.
Shigeko Sasamori, remembering 58 years ago today, the day the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. She was 13 years old. We'll be back with her in a minute.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell, and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction.
Sarah Friedman. Is it for Sarah Thompson? Is it for freedom here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report? I'm Amy Goodman. In a minute, we go to the radio adaptation of John Hersey's classic work, Hiroshima. Shigeki Sasamori attended the production of the Pacifica Radio Archives recording of John Hersey's book. I asked her what it was like to listen.
When I listened to that program, my heart is so calm, yet my both eye, the hot water coming down, tears, like hot water. I'm not crying, I'm not conscious, but water runs. I just stood the lesson, I didn't even wipe. I just let go and just memory come back. Think of all the people die, the one drop, the bomb, and especially people are very innocent. They didn't know what the war is, and the little children, the babies, and those people involved. And just most horrible war weapon that at the time I never heard. But now this day, much, much more strong nuclear weapons. Never we should use again. I wish people who are planning to have a war or planning to drop those things should go to Hiroshima and to see Memorial Museum, Hiroshima City. They show us many pictures, they explain, and many people go Hiroshima, went to Hiroshima and saw those things. They are so impressed and they felt, oh, that's a horrible thing. Never happened again. So, also I feel, not just top people, everybody, because we are choosing those people, president and congressmen. So, everybody has to have education. How war is a horrible thing. The many people, when I hear once, that the time impressed and, oh, horrible. Then time passed, forgets. That's why, see, I'm not wanted to be on the television to show my face, but this is important. I have a mission to tell people how terrible was, the people to recognize war is nothing good. So that's why people ask me, television, newspaper, anything, any chance, I like to people to understand, and not just understand, action. People to be action, very important. No more war, no more Hiroshima.
Shigeko Sasamori was 13 when the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. She is back in Hiroshima today to remember, 58 years ago today. As we turn now to the radio adaptation from the Pacifica Radio Archives of John Hersey's classic work, Hiroshima, the most famous work of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and reporter. An account of the bombing of Hiroshima in 1945 told from the perspective of six survivors. Today, we hear an excerpt of that radio adaptation. This is told from the perspective of one of those survivors, Dr. Sasaki.
On the train, on the way into Hiroshima from the country where he lived with his mother, Dr. Terofumi Sasaki, the Red Cross hospital surgeon, thought over an unpleasant nightmare he had had the night before. His mother's home was 30 miles from the city, and it took him 2 hours by train and tram to reach the hospital. He had slept uneasily all night and had wakened an hour earlier than usual, and feeling sluggish and slightly feverish, had debated whether to go to the hospital at all. His sense of duty finally forced him to go, and he had started out on an earlier train than he took most mornings. He was only 25 years old and had just completed his training at the Eastern Medical University in Tsingtao, China. At the terminal, he caught a streetcar at once. He later calculated that if he had taken his customary train that morning, and if he had had to wait a few minutes for the streetcar, as often happened, he would have been close to the center at the time of the explosion and would surely have perished. He arrived at the hospital at 7:40 and reported to the chief surgeon. A few minutes later, he went to a room on the first floor and drew blood from the arm of a man in order to perform a Wasserman test. The laboratory containing the incubators for the test was on the third floor. With the blood specimen in his left hand, walking in a kind of distraction he had felt all morning, probably because of the dream and his restless night, he started along the main corridor on his way toward the stairs. He was one step beyond an open window when the light of the bomb was reflected like a gigantic photographic flash in the corridor. He ducked down on one knee and said to himself, as only a Japanese would, "Sasaki, gambare, be brave." Just then, the building was 1,650 yards from the center. The blast ripped through the hospital. The glasses he was wearing flew off his face. The bottle of blood crashed against one wall. His Japanese slippers zipped out from under his feet, but otherwise, thanks to where he stood, he was untouched. Dr. Sasaki shouted the name of the chief surgeon and rushed around to the men's office and found him terribly cut by glass. The hospital was in horrible confusion. Heavy partitions and ceilings had fallen on patients. Beds had overturned. Windows had blown in and cut people. Blood was spattered on the walls and the floors. Instruments were everywhere. Many of the patients were running about, screaming. Many more lay dead. A colleague working in the laboratory to which Dr. Sasaki had been walking was dead. Dr. Sasaki's patient, whom he had just left and who a few minutes before had been dreadfully afraid of syphilis, was also dead. Dr. Sasaki found himself the only doctor in the hospital who was unhurt. Dr. Sasaki, who believed that the enemy had hit only the building he was in, got bandages and began to bind the wounds of those inside the hospital, while outside, all over Hiroshima, maimed and dying citizens turned their unsteady steps toward the Red Cross Hospital to begin an invasion that was to make Dr. Sasaki forget his private nightmare for a long, long time.
Of 150 doctors in the city, 65 were already dead. and most of the rest were wounded. Of 1,780 nurses, 1,654 were dead or too badly hurt to work. In the biggest hospital, that of the Red Cross, only 6 doctors out of 30 were able to function, and only 10 nurses out of more than 200.
The sole uninjured doctor on the Red Cross hospital staff was Dr. Sasaki. After the explosion, he hurried to a storeroom to fetch bandages. This room, like everything he had seen as he ran through the hospital, was chaotic. Bottles of medicine thrown off shelves and broken. Salves spattered on the walls. Instruments strewn everywhere. He grabbed up some bandages and an unbroken bottle of mercurochrome, hurried back to the chief surgeon and bandaged his cuts. Then he went out into the corridor and began patching up the wounded patients and the doctors and nurses there. He blundered so without his glasses that he took a pair off the face of a wounded nurse. And although they only approximately compensated for the errors of his vision, they were better than nothing. He was to depend on them for more than a month. Dr. Sasaki worked without method, taking those who were nearest him first, and he noticed soon that the corridor seemed to be getting more and more crowded, mixed in with the abrasions and lacerations which most people in the hospital had suffered. He began to find dreadful burns. He realized then that casualties were pouring in from outdoors. Before long, patients lay and crouched on the floors, on the wards and the laboratories and all the other rooms, and in the corridors and on the stairs and in the front hall and under the porte-cochere and on the stone front steps and in the driveway and courtyard and for blocks each way in the streets outside. Wounded people supported maimed people. Disfigured families leaned together. Many people were vomiting. In a city of 245,000, nearly 100,000 people had been killed or doomed at one blow. 100,000 more were hurt. At least 10,000 of the wounded made their way to the best hospital in town. Bewildered by the numbers, staggered by so much raw flesh, Dr. Sasaki lost all sense of profession and stopped working as a skillful surgeon and a sympathetic man. He became an automaton, mechanically wiping, daubing, winding, wiping, daubing, winding.
Early in the evening of the day the bomb exploded, a Japanese naval launch moved slowly down the 7 rivers of Hiroshima. It stopped here and there to make an announcement, alongside the crowded sandspits on which hundreds of wounded lay, at bridges on which others were crowded, and eventually, as twilight fell, opposite Asano Park. A young officer stood up in the launch and shouted through a megaphone.
Be patient. A naval hospital ship is coming to take care of you.
The sight of the ship-shaped launch against the background of the havoc across the river, the unruffled young man in his neat uniform, above all, the promise of medical help, the first word of possible succor anyone had heard in nearly 12 awful hours, cheered the people in the park tremendously.
By nightfall, 10,000 victims of the explosion had invaded the Red Cross hospital, and Dr. Sasaki, worn out, was moving aimlessly and dully up and down the stinking corridors with wads of bandage and bottles of mercurochrome, still wearing the glasses he had taken from the wounded nurse, binding up the worst cuts as he came to them. Other doctors were putting compresses of saline solution on the worst burns. That was all they could do. After dark, they worked by the light of the city's fires and by candles the 10 remaining nurses held for them. Dr. Sasaki had not looked outside the hospital all day. Patients were dying by the hundreds, but there was nobody to carry away the corpses. Some of the hospital staff distributed biscuits and rice balls, but the charnel house smell was so strong that few were hungry. By 3 o'clock the next morning, after 19 straight hours of his gruesome work, Dr. Sasaki was incapable of dressing another wound. He and some other survivors of the hospital staff got straw mats and went outdoors. Thousands of patients and hundreds of dead were in the yard and on the driveway. They hurried around behind the hospital and lay down in hiding to snatch some sleep. But within an hour, wounded people had found them. A complaining circle formed around them.
Doctors!
Help us! How can you sleep?
Help us, doctors!
Help us, doctors!
Help us! How can you sleep?
Dr. Sasaki got up again and went back to work. Early in the day, he thought for the first time of his mother at their country home in Mukaihara, 30 miles from town. He usually went home every night. He was afraid she would think he was dead.
Early that day, August 7th, the Japanese radio broadcast for the first time a succinct announcement that very few, if any, of the people most concerned with its content, the survivors in Hiroshima, happened to hear.
Hiroshima suffered considerable damage as the result of an attack by a few B-29s. It is believed that a new type of bomb was used. The details are being investigated.
Nor is it probable that any of the survivors happened to be tuned in on the shortwave rebroadcast of an extraordinary announcement by the President of the United States, which identified the new bomb as atomic.
That bomb had more power than 20,000 tons of TNT. It had more than 2,000 times the blast power of the British Grand Slam, which is the largest bomb ever yet used in the history of warfare.
Those victims who were able to worry at all about what had happened thought of it and discussed it in more primitive, childish terms.
Gasoline sprinkled from an airplane,
or some
maybe.
Combustible gas.
Or a big cluster of incendiaries.
Or the work of
parachutists. Mm.
But even if they had known the truth, most of them were too busy or too weary or too badly hurt to care that they were the objects of the first great experiment in the use of atomic power, which, as the voices on the shortwave shouted,
no country except the United States, with its industrial know-how, its willingness to throw $2 billion into an important wartime gamble, could possibly have developed it.
At the Red Cross Hospital, Dr. Sasaki worked for 3 straight days with only 1 hour sleep. On the second day, he began to sew up the worst cuts, and right through the following night and all the next day, he stitched. Many of the wounds were festered. Fortunately, someone had found intact a supply of narukopon, a Japanese sedative, and he gave it to many who were in pain. Word went around among the staff that there must have been something peculiar about the great bomb, because on the second day, the vice chief of the hospital went down in the basement to the vault where the X-ray plates were stored and found the whole stock exposed as they lay. In the afternoon of the third day, exhausted from his foul tailoring, Dr. Sasaki became obsessed with the idea that his mother thought he was dead. He got permission to go to Mukaihara. He reached home late in the evening. His mother said she had known he was right all along. A wounded nurse had stopped by to tell her. He went to bed and slept for 17 hours.
You're listening to a radio adaptation of John Hersey's book, Hiroshima. We'll be back with it in a minute.
Mothers were boiling rice. Thousand prisoners of war were rolling their dice, hoping they'd survive this terrible storm. When each young man in his uniform vanished in the air in the blink of an eye. One moment they lived, on the next they all died. Hiroshima. Hiroshima. Ten thousand. their wings.
David Rovick singing Hiroshima here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we return to the radio adaptation of John Hersey's classic book, Hiroshima, narrated by Ruby Dee.
At 2 minutes after 11 o'clock on the morning of August 9th, the second atomic bomb was dropped on Nagasaki. It was several days before the survivors of Hiroshima knew they had company, because the Japanese radio and newspapers were being extremely cautious on the subject of the strange weapon. About a week after the bomb dropped, a vague, incomprehensible rumor reached Hiroshima that the city had been destroyed by the energy released when atoms were somehow split in two. The weapon was referred to in this word-of-mouth report as Genshi Bakudan, the root characters of which can be translated as original child bomb.
A comparative orderliness, at least, began to be established at the Red Cross Hospital. Dr. Sasaki, back from his rest, undertook to classify his patients. The staff gradually swept up the debris. Best of all, the nurses and attendants started to remove the corpses. Disposal of the dead by decent cremation and enshrinement is a greater moral responsibility to the Japanese than adequate care of the living. Relatives identified most of the first day's dead in and around the hospital. Beginning on the second day, whenever a patient appeared to be moribund, a piece of paper with his name on it was fastened to his clothing. The corpse detail carried the bodies to a clearing outside, placed them on piles of wood from ruined houses, burned them, put some of the ashes in envelopes intended for exposed X-ray plates, marked the envelopes with the names of the deceased, and piled them neatly and respectfully in stacks in the main office. In a few days, the envelopes filled one whole side of the impromptu shrine.
On the morning of August 15th, the dull, dispirited voice of Hirohito, the Emperor Tenno, was speaking for the first time in history over the radio.
After pondering deeply the general trends of the world and the actual condition obtaining in our empire today, we have decided to effect a settlement of present situation by resorting to an extraordinary measure.
Since Miss Sasaki was a woman and was so sick, and perhaps he afterward admitted just a little bit because she was named Sasaki, Dr. Sasaki put her on a mat in a semi-private room, which at that time had only 8 people in it. He wanted to set a fracture and put her leg in a cast, but he had run out of plaster of Paris long since, so he just stretched her out on a mat and prescribed aspirin for a fever, and glucose intravenously and diastas orally for her undernourishment, which he had not entered on a record because everyone suffered from it. She exhibited only one of the queer symptoms so many of his patients were just then beginning to show: the spot hemorrhages.
Japanese physicists who knew a great deal about atomic fission, one of them owned a cyclotron, worried about lingering radiation at Hiroshima. In mid-August, they entered the city. The scientists determined that the exact center was a spot 150 yards south of the Torii and a few yards southeast of the pile of ruins that had once been the Shima Hospital. The scientists noticed that the flash of the bomb had scorched certain types of building material and, in some places, left prints of the shadows that had been cast by its light. A few vague human silhouettes were found, and these gave rise to stories. One story told how a painter on a ladder was monumentalized in a kind of bas-relief on the stone facade of a bank building on which he was at work in the act of dipping his brush into his paint can. Another, how a man and his cart on the bridge near the Museum of Science and Industry, almost under the center of the explosion, were cast down in an embossed shadow which made it clear that the man was about to whip his horse. The scientists in early September made new measurements, and the highest radiation they found this time was 3.9 times the natural leak. Since radiation of at least 1,000 times the natural leak would be required to cause serious effects on the human body, the scientists announced that people could enter Hiroshima without any peril at all.
Dr. Sasaki and his colleagues at the Red Cross Hospital watched the unprecedented disease unfold. It had, they decided, three stages. The first stage was the direct reaction to the bombardment of the body at the moment when the bomb went off by neutrons, beta particles, and gamma rays. It killed 95% of the people within half a mile of the center, and many thousands were further away. The rays simply destroyed body cells. The second stage set in 10 or 15 days after the bombing. Its first symptom was falling hair. Diarrhea and fever came next. 25 to 30 days after the explosion, the white blood cell count dropped sharply. The two key symptoms on which the doctors came to base their prognosis were fever and the lowered white corpuscle count. If fever remained steady and high, the patient's chances for survival were poor. A patient whose count fell below 1,000 had little hope of living. The third stage was the reaction that came when the body struggled to compensate for its ills. The duration of the disease varied depending on the patient's constitution and the amount of radiation he had received. Some victims recovered in a week. With others, the disease dragged on for months. Whatever its source, the disease had some baffling quirks. Not all the patients exhibited all the main symptoms. People who suffered flash burns were protected to a considerable extent from radiation sickness. Those who had lain quietly for days or even hours after the bombing were much less liable to get sick than those who had been active. Gray hair seldom fell out. And, as if nature were protecting man against his own ingenuity, the reproductive processes were affected. For a time, men became sterile. Women had miscarriages. Menstruation stopped.
Giving Miss Sasaki a local anesthetic of procaine, Dr. Sasaki made an incision in her leg on October 23rd to drain the infection, which still lingered on 11 weeks after the injury. Her spirits fell low. Her leg had been so swollen and painful all along that the doctor had not even tried to set the fractures, and though an X-ray taken in November showed that the bones were mending, she could see under the sheet that her left leg was nearly 3 inches shorter than her right, and that her left foot was turning inward.
Scientists swarmed into the city. They found that mica, of which the melting point is 900 degrees centigrade, had fused on granite gravestones 380 yards from the center, and that the surface of gray clay tiles of the type used in Hiroshima, whose melting point is 1,300 degrees centigrade, had dissolved at 600 yards. They concluded that the bomb's heat on the ground at the center must have been 6,000 degrees centigrade. General MacArthur's headquarters systematically censored all mention of the bomb in Japanese scientific publications. But soon, the fruit of the scientists' calculations became common knowledge. Long before the American public had been told, most of the scientists and lots of non-scientists in Japan knew from the calculations of Japanese nuclear physicists that a uranium bomb had exploded at Hiroshima and a more powerful one of plutonium at Nagasaki. They also knew that, theoretically, one 10 times as powerful, or 20, could be developed. They estimated that even with the primitive bomb used at Hiroshima, it would require a shelter of concrete 50 inches thick to protect a human being entirely from radiation sickness. The scientists had these and other details, which remained subject to security in the United States, printed and mimeographed and bound into little books. Altogether, the Japanese scientists were somewhat amused at the efforts of their conquerors to keep security on atomic fission.
It took 6 months for the Red Cross Hospital, and even longer for Dr. Sasaki, to get back to normal. For the first 4 months, Dr. Sasaki was the only surgeon on the staff, and he almost never left the building. Then gradually, he began to take an interest in his own life again. He got married in March. He gained back some of the weight he lost, but his appetite remained only fair. Before the bombing, he used to eat 4 rice balls at every meal, but a year after it, he could only manage 2. He felt tired all the time. "But I have to realize," he said, "that the whole community is tired."
A surprising number of the people of Hiroshima remain more or less indifferent about the ethics of using the bomb. Possibly they were too terrified by it to want to think about it at all. Not many of them even bothered to find out much about what it was like. Many citizens of Hiroshima, however, continued to feel a hatred for Americans which nothing could possibly erase.
"I see that they are holding a trial for war criminals in Tokyo just now. I think they ought to try the men who decided to use the bomb, and they should hang them all."
It would be impossible to say what horrors were embedded in the minds of the children who lived through the day of the bombing in Hiroshima. On the surface, their recollections months after the disaster were of an exhilarating adventure. Toshio Nakamura, who was 10 at the time of the bombing, was soon able to talk freely, even gaily, about the experience. And a few weeks before the anniversary, he wrote the following matter-of-fact essay for his teacher at Noboricho Primary School.
"The day before the bomb, I went for a swim. In the morning, I was eating peanuts. I saw a light. I was knocked to little sister's sleeping place. When we were saved, I could only see as far as the tram. My mother and I started to pack our things. The neighbors were walking around burned and bleeding. Hataya-san told me to run away with her. I said I wanted to wait for my mother. We went to the park. A whirlwind came. At night, a gas tank burned and I saw the reflection in the river. We stayed in the park one night. Next day, I went to Taiko Bridge and met my girlfriends Kikuki and Murakami. They were looking for their mothers. But Kikuki's mother was wounded, and Murakami's mother, alas, was dead."
That was an excerpt of John Hersey's Hiroshima, adapted for radio by John Valentine. The narrators were Ruby Dee and John Valentine. Michael Shinya-Marinde was the voice of Dr. Sasaki. Michael Haney was the director of this production of John Hersey's classic. Executive producers Robert Greenwald and Kate McCardle. The piece was produced by Artists United and the Feminist Majority, as well as the Pacifica Radio Archives, with Brian DeShazer, Mark Snow, Steve Barker, Mark Torres, and Hope Burley. If you'd like a copy of today's program, video or audio, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Lenina Nadal, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, and Ulpa Patel. I'm Amy Goodman. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Thanks for joining us.
And convenience? Is it a profit?